Good evening. I appreciate everyone coming out. It looks like we might have at least as big a crowd as the previous nights and maybe slightly larger. That means the rain and the opening of the fair didn't discourage anybody. That's good. Tonight I want to open by fulfilling a commitment that I made to Dr. Payne regarding hypotheses of abiogenesis or speculations on the natural origins of life. I also want to make some comments, the first of many, regarding Dr. Payne's model for scientific creationism, which I am grateful to say we saw Tuesday night. And I'll do this as we go along discussing origin of life hypotheses. Dr. Payne's model of scientific creationism is different somewhat from the model of scientific creationism pushed by the Institute for Creation Research. And although some of what I presented earlier does apply to Dr. Payne's model, his model does differ primarily in that it does not take an overt position on the age of the earth or the universe. So it is not strictly proper at best to call Dr. Payne's model scientific creationism when Dr. Morris beat him to that title by about 13 years. So let's call Dr. Payne's model scientific creation 2. Or scientific creationism 2. That way, we preserve the connection between the statement of debate and the model that we're now currently talking about. Without being confusing regarding it and the far more widely promoted ICR model. And after finally seeing Dr. Payne's model and thinking about it, I believe that he is to be commended for changing from the ICR tenet of the earth being only about 6 to 10,000 years old. Because that is one of the two tenets of the ICR model, which was actually testable against empirical evidence and the evidence of geological history, and this tenet of the age of the earth being 6 to 10,000 years old has failed the test of evidence. And so Dr. Payne has shown that, at least to this extent, he does respect evidence, and he is willing to capitulate and modify somewhat in the face of a propensity of scientific evidence regarding the age of the earth. He has at least compromised his model a little bit and distinguished it from the ICR model. The ICR creation scientists are sure the earth is about 6 to 10,000 years old or thereabouts, but Dr. Payne's position now is that he is not sure of how old it is. He's simply sure that it's not 4.5 billion years old. He's not prepared to compromise the model that far yet, and that's fine. We've presented much evidence that compels the scientific community to accept 4.5 billion years as the age of the earth currently. And we'll be interested to hear more about Dr. Payne's assessment of that evidence. Now, the origin of life is one of the so-called scientific creationists' favorite subjects. Some of them like to tell you that if life did arise from non-life by natural causes, natural means, that evolution cannot be true. But this is false, and I'll illustrate this using the words of Judge Overton that were taken from his Arkansas Creationist Act judgment. And quote, although the subject of the origins of life is within the province of biology, the scientific community does not consider origins of life a part of evolutionary theory. The theory of evolution assumes the existence of life and is directed to an explanation of how life evolved. Evolution does not presuppose an absence of a creator, God, end quote. In other words, the formal theory of evolution does not deal with the origin of life in the first place, but only with what happened next after it got here, with what changes it experienced and by what processes it may have diversified. So even if you leave this debate feeling that somehow there had to be a creator to get life going, you can still believe in evolution because it's a different subject. And that's how many evolutionists believe, that there is a creator God lying behind nature, but that he created nature capable of producing life naturally according to the physical laws and rules of chemistry and physics, which the creator built into nature. That's a religious opinion, not a scientific one, but that is an opinion held by many. However, I'm not going to duck the issue of the origin of life just because it isn't really a part of evolution. In the next few minutes, I'll, as quickly as possible, review some of the scientific findings in this area and also show you why arguments made by the creationists to the effect that origin of life in nature is impossible are incorrect. Like any part of science, research into the origin of life seeks to explain as much as possible without relying on supernatural events. This, of course, is because supernatural events cannot be investigated by the methods of science. Well, that's not to say that there isn't supernatural reality at all. It simply says that you've got to go get another tool if you want to investigate supernatural reality. Natural science deals with physical nature. However, our knowledge, nature, or the natural origin of life, is still a new area of science, and we don't know a whole lot about it, but there have been many exciting developments recently. Our knowledge of how life could have arisen by natural processes is, however, quite limited, admittedly, and no scientist will tell you that we know exactly how, or even exactly whether, life did arise by natural processes. So let's talk just a minute about the spontaneous generation of life. Louis Pasteur demonstrated by experimentation that life, that complex life, does not arise from non-life spontaneously. And there is no argument for me about this. Dr. Payne is a marvelous public speaker, very effective, and I admire that very much. And he did an excellent job of covering this subject of spontaneous generation. The other night, he argued convincingly from Pasteur's work that in nature, which is the proper realm, investigative realm of science, in nature, complex forms of life do not arise spontaneously. And he's absolutely correct. Nature does not create complex life. But what puzzles me is that the first tenet of the scientific creation model, too, says that first life was created abruptly in complex form. He argues convincingly that, scientifically, complex forms of life do not arise spontaneously, but he says it is scientific to postulate that life was created abruptly in complex form. Now, I know that he knows invoking a supernatural agent as an explanation for this removes his model from science. It disqualifies his model from the title scientific. And I know he knows this because I overheard him say so in a conversation he was having with biologist Bill Diebold after the debate Tuesday night. So if Dr. Payne wants to say as a part of his scientific creation model that life was created abruptly in complex form, it seems he will have to first overcome his own very convincing argument that scientifically we now know that life does not arise from non-life in complex form. Now, before we can seriously entertain his scientific creation model, too, as providing a scientific explanation for the history of life on Earth, we need to hear a scientific explanation for the model itself, a scientific reconciliation between what his model says and what he himself has already argued cannot happen scientifically in nature. Now, let me quickly add that I did not have a chance to review this material or time it, so the clock may run out on me, and I've got a number of things that I want to say on Origin of Life, and I want to give a full saying to the commitment that I made to cover this. So if it runs out, I'll pick it up in my second 20 minutes. I'm going to try to get this done, though. Okay, now, Pasteur disproved the notion, originally derived from common experience, that complex organisms of life, such as flies and maggots and mice, arise spontaneously. And this presents a real problem for the claim of the scientific legitimacy of the scientific creation model, too. But it does not pose a similar problem for the origin of life hypotheses, because scientists do not think that first life arose either spontaneously, in any normal sense or ordinary sense, or that it arose in the form of complex organisms. Pasteur's experimental demonstrations did not put to test the hypothesis that life arose from non-life by a long and propitious series of small, incrementally contributing steps of chemical evolution. Origin of life scientists are not arguing for the sudden arrival of complex organisms by spontaneous generation. Rather than impede the origin of life hypothesis, Pasteur's experiments actually have made a contribution to the origin of life scenario by demonstrating that if life did arise naturally, it must have been by a mechanism of chemical evolution and not by spontaneous generation. Most of the research on the origin of life has dealt with showing how these simple molecules from living cells are made and how they can be formed using chemicals and processes that might reasonably have occurred in the primitive Earth. For example, electric sparks or ultraviolet light are passed through mixtures of water, hydrogen, methane, ammonia, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, or hydrogen sulfide. You see those listed here. All very simple molecules present even in outer space, these. Now, I don't have a chart of the apparatus used for these experiments, but if memory serves me right, David Aiken has one, and possibly Dr. Payne will use it later, and then you'll see it. Now, this table lists the starting materials that I named and shows names of some of the chemicals that are produced simply from an input of electrical energy or ultraviolet light. And some of these compounds are quite complex. They're much more complex and includes most of the amino acids, which are found in proteins. It includes these products that are produced in this fashion. Adenine, which is a purine found in genetic material, DNA and RNA. And there are a variety of other compounds that are found. So you take these and you zap them with electricity or ultraviolet light, and you get very much more complex compounds, many of them found, and some of them vital to life. Next chart. This chart shows some of the structures of these products. Pull it down just a little bit, Tom. At the top, we have the structure of the starting materials, and then these are a variety of the products that are produced in this fashion. You can see that they're much more complex. Now, scientists can do some things in the laboratory which we don't observe in nature, but surely scientists cannot do anything in the laboratory that would violate a law of nature. I don't think scientists can violate laws of nature. And these experiments demonstrate that chemical reactions do occur spontaneously with an input of energy and result in chemical products which are more complex than the starting materials. Now, this is one of the many reasons why scientists are unimpressed by the second law of thermodynamics arguments that creationists make against the origin of life experiments. Scientists know full well that neither origin of life nor evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics. That is to say that there are reactions which, in the right conditions, with the right energy available, spontaneously produce more complex products than the starting materials. Now, starting with more complex materials than these, which themselves can be formed in the simpler experiments. In other words, we run this, we take some of these products, and now we're going to do a new experiment with some of those. Guanine and uracil, also found in RNA, have been formed. So we've gotten a couple of more DNA RNA bases. Additionally, it is likely that the sugar ribose needed for RNA can be formed from formaldehyde under conditions of the primitive Earth. Now, none of this proves anything in any absolute way, but it certainly does provide good evidence that the basic building blocks of life can form in the absence of life. Next slide. Let's start. And we have even more direct evidence for this. Such chemical building blocks of life have been found from meteorites arriving from outer space. It is quite remarkable that in a single meteorite, all five types of bases found in the genetic material of life on Earth, adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, and uracil, all five DNA bases, RNA bases, and as well as a number of other amino acids and alcohols, aldehydes, all compounds common to life. Now, this was from a meteorite arriving from elsewhere. Now, this, again, does not prove, but certainly strongly suggests that life on Earth is based on molecules that can readily form in the absence of life in nature. Now, the next step in the origin of life experiments is to put some of these relatively complex pieces, formed from the simple chemicals, together to make some even more complex molecules found in living cells. This next chart shows you some of the progress that has been made in this area. As you can hopefully see, with just heat and some small molecules and ions around, The building blocks of life can and do assemble into larger molecules or polymers. We start with the purine and pyrimidine bases. Add a little heat, some ribose, we can get nucleosides. Add the phosphate for the backbone, and we get the nucleotides. With imidazole, and I'm sorry, I know that a lot of you don't know what that is, and I'm not sure I can remember. We get phosphoimidazolides. I think I'm close on that. And they can form polynucleotides up to 50 units. Now, this isn't something where chemists, we're not talking about experiments where synthetic chemists are using all their skills and wile and know-how to end-to-end various reactions to produce some tailor-fitted product. That's not the kind of reactions that we're talking about here. We're talking, in essence, about let's lump it together, zap it, let it cook, and then take a look at it and imitate, best we are able, processes that we believe happen in nature and that we think could have easily happened in the primitive earth. Amino acids with just heat and water can form polypeptides up to 50 units. Fatty acids and glycerol and phosphate and heat can form phospholipids, and they then form spontaneously membranes, form themselves into membranes. Now, do life scientists consider this proof of abiogenesis? No, certainly it is not proof. But compelling, you bet your DNA, this is compelling evidence supporting hypothesis of natural origin of life. Now let's talk about the progress which has been made in understanding the much more complicated things that have been required to form living cells in nature. Some of these are fairly complicated, and as Dr. Payne frequently but correctly observes, we don't have time to say too much about them. Without any violation of the second law of thermodynamics, polymeric molecules, such as are found in living cells, can and do spontaneously organize themselves and carry out complex functions. RNA can be made to copy itself or replicate and even evolve in the test tube. These are, I'm just highlighting work that has been done, and these are the results. Now, the problem of how genetic material could have shaped and processed, before enzymes has evolved has apparently been solved by the finding that RNA itself can sometimes act as an enzyme. This was reported in the Courier Journal, as well as the scientific literature, this January, for those of you who live in Louisville, and you may have seen it. This addresses the problem that Dr. Payne quoted Karl Popper on, about the vicious circle of which came first, the enzyme or RNA. It looks like RNA could have done some of its own dirty work in the very early beginnings of life. And this shows how suddenly insurmountable problems can sometimes begin to resolve through continued thorough research. Now, an intriguing new proposal of life is now getting a lot of attention, and that's the idea that clay, an inorganic mineral material which possesses the ability of forming spontaneously and copying complex types of information, might have played a crucial role in the origin of life. Now, this is a new hypothesis that has a fair amount of support gaining for it. Now, there's still very much we don't understand, many things that are puzzling, but scientists freely admit this. We freely admit we don't know it all. One reason our knowledge of the origin of life is limited is that none of the processes that have been taking place have left any direct evidence, like fossils. Chemical evolution doesn't do that. It may well be that we will never know many of the details. Nevertheless, it is the nature of science to keep investigating these questions. Remember that it was only about 30 years ago that the structure of DNA was discovered, and today we can synthesize genes in the laboratory. Who can say what the next 30 or 100 or 300 years of research will discover? I'm confident we won't discover anything which a creator God does not want us to, and so surely we have nothing to fear from this research. It seems to me that the creationist looks at things and says, I don't see how this could happen by a natural process, so it must have been created. The scientist says, I don't know how this could have happened by natural processes either, but I'm sure going to try to find out. I have more to say on this, but almost certainly my time's about to run out, and this is a good place to stop, so I thank you for listening.
I want to add my word to Frank's to express appreciation for your presence. We have an excellent crowd again tonight, as we have throughout the week. And I hope that it has been stimulating to everyone that has been here. It certainly has to me. In fact, sometimes so stimulating it's hard to go to sleep at night. I expect Frank's had some of that same experience. But it's been a good week, and we've appreciated your attendance. I have some things prepared that I want to say during this first 20 minutes. I think I should say at least that Mr. Lovell's presentation in this first 20 minutes was most interesting, and I might add, rather simplistic. And I intend to fully respond to the points that he has made, but not right here at this juncture. There are answers to each one of the things that he said, very clearly presented. Have a book I might like to recommend to you if you'd like to read it further that's very detailed on this entire subject and comes up with the opposite conclusion. However, I'd like to take the time I have right now to make some points of rebuttal in some respects to some things Mr. Lovell said on the first two nights. He used some expressions Tuesday night with reference to some of the things Henry Morris and Duane Gish have said, and with reference to the scientific creation model. He referred to them as a monumental fraud, as pathetic science, and as an egregious error, which means a whopper, he said. And that was his opinion of some of the things that they had done. I tried on Tuesday night, for those of you who are not able to be here, to show that that is not a one-sided story. And I would like to simply ask Mr. Lovell tonight if he is willing to say publicly that some of the statements of the leaders of the evolution movement are in fact a monumental fraud. An egregious error. Gould, and one of the quotes that I gave you on Tuesday night, said that the fact of the gaps in the sudden appearance in the fossil record had been known for many years, as did Niles Eldridge. He called it something like the emperor's new clothes. That the paleontologists knew and was their trade secret, but they wouldn't tell the public. That's what they said. Now, I would like to ask Mr. Lovell, if paleontologists knew this all along and kept it from the public, was that not pathetic science? Go to the next one. If a professor of genetics at Harvard University will make a statement in public like this, it's time for students of the evolutionary process, especially those who've been misquoted and used by the creationists, to state clearly that evolution is fact, not theory. Birds arose from non-birds, humans from non-humans. No person who pretends to any understanding of the natural world can deny these facts any more than he or she can deny that the earth is round, rotates on its axis, and revolves around the sun. I read a quote Tuesday night from the same Richard Lewontin in an interview with Tom Bethel, in which he said that statement was very weak. But he didn't publish a comparable statement to the public to refute it. Is that pseudoscience and an egregious error? Go to the next one. No, that's not it. It's the other one. Right there. With regard to human evolution, I quoted from the National Academy of Sciences. And I will not read this whole thing tonight, but in that quotation, they make the statement that there's no reason anymore to doubt human evolution exactly how it occurred. The missing links are there. We went on to show you that they are not, absolutely not, and that many evolutionists say that the lineage that's traced back to common ancestries in worse shape than it was before. And they make a statement like this to the public to say it is absolutely solved. Is that pathetic science? I asked Mr. Lovell this after the debate Tuesday night, and he said he didn't agree with the National Academy of Sciences. He didn't agree with Richard Lewontin. He thought they were wrong in that. I do too. Now I'd like to turn to a point he brought up on Tuesday night, in which he dealt with a portion of the earth's surface. He made the statement, you can look into the earth and see that evolution must be true. He referred to the Green River formation found in Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah. And in addition to that, he referred to a quote made from Henry Morris, which I'll get to in a moment. I thought I ought to look a little more up about that. I didn't know a whole lot about the Green River Formation. I had heard of it, but I hadn't studied it much. So I went and did a little reference work, and I found an article on it and a book that referred to it. And interestingly enough, the latest National Geographic, I think he mentioned, has some pictures in it from the Green River Formation. And from these references that I found, they said that this formation was some 2,000 to 2,600 feet thick. Now, Mr. Lovell last night said it was 2 miles thick. I'm not sure if that was taken from another source or if it was just a mistake, but these references I saw said 2,000 feet. I don't say that that's a huge problem, but it is like 400% off. And there were some, according to the article, some 2,000 seams of material per foot, which would make about 1/100th of an inch per seam. And he made the observation that each of these seams was a varve, which was laid down each year. And so if there are 2,000 of them per foot, and you've got some 2,600 feet, that calculates roughly to 6 million years rather than 50 million, as he said last Tuesday night. But the problem with that is, it's not at all clear geologically, and I understand the geologists are disagreed, as to whether these seam-like formations are really varves that are deposited annually. There's considerable disagreement about that, from what I can see. And in addition to that, if you'd have the next one, here is a transparency of one of the fossils that is shown in this National Geographic. And I hope you can see reasonably well that that is a pretty well-preserved fossil fish. And you may be able to see that in his mouth is another smaller fossil fish, which he was about to eat. And that's trapped in that same Green River formation, as are any of a host of other fossil fish. In fact, we may have the quote now, Mr. Lovell referred to a quote from Henry Morris's book, Science, Scripture, and the Young Earth, which I was not familiar with. So I asked one of my cohorts, or he volunteered actually, to try to get the book for me, and he went to the library and got it today. And on page 12 of that book, you see the following. And let me just read this paragraph with you. As a matter of fact, this formation, speaking of the Green River Formation, as well as other so-called lacustrine deposits in the geological column, has been the subject of considerable controversy even among orthodox geologists. For one thing, it is to a considerable extent a fossil graveyard, and is, as even Young admits, extensive beds of vertebrate fossils certainly imply catastrophic burials. Not only are the extensive beds of fossilized fish found there, but even great deposits of fossil birds, as well as other animals. And Mr. Lovell mentioned the fossils last night, too. Some of them very well preserved. Now, the quote that was in question in the discussion last night, about which Mr. Lovell made the statement, an egregious error, no, I don't believe that's what that was about. No, it was a misquotation. Was right here, where you see the arrows. You'll note that in the two quotes that Mr. Morris is making, and I really am not here to defend Mr. Morris, but I think at least this much ought to be said. He says, the discovery of abundant fossil catfish and oil shales in the Green River Formation, that's a quote from one paper. He's trying to illustrate that there are lots of fossils in that formation. Furthermore, if you could move it up a little now, fossil catfish are distributed in Green River Basin, in the Green River Basin, over an area of 16,000 kilometers squared. The catfish range in length from 11 to 24 centimeters, with a mean of 18 centimeters. Preservation is excellent, as you saw in the picture. In some specimens, even the skin and other soft parts, including the adipose fin, are well preserved. And then the next two lines are in there, strongly suggest that the catfish could have been transported to their site of fossilization. Those two lines are in there. You'll note if you read, though, it doesn't even make a complete sentence if you add those last two lines. And in the book that was checked out from that library, there was an errata statement tacked in the book, which said lines 18 and 19 should be deleted. So if you'll move it up, this is lines 18 and 19 right here. And those are the ones that made the quote look so terrible. Now, I suspect he didn't have that in his, and I fully would understand that. But evidently, Mr. Morris, just somebody, when they typed that up, just typed in two extra lines that didn't even belong there. And Mr. Lovell made a pretty serious charge about bad scholarship against Mr. Morris last night, and it may be that somebody caught his bad scholarship and he went around and put these things in it. Could be. I suspect it was just a mistake. I hope so. I'd like to grant him that. And I think Mr. Lovell would too. And so I wanted to clear that point up on behalf of Mr. Morris. Even as I've said, I'm not here trying to defend Mr. Morris in particular. But with regard to the Green River Formation, there is a real problem right here with these extremely well-preserved fossils. They are so well preserved that they even have skin parts, or at least what looks like the skins left, as well as the bony parts and parts of the fins. Highly unusual. Now my question is, if those layers, those seams, were all deposited 1/100th of an inch at a time per year, okay, and you've got fish that are maybe 3 or 4 inches tall, how'd they get trapped in there with all of their parts left at 1/100th of an inch per year? That just doesn't happen. Fossils that are that well preserved had to have been suddenly trapped. Now, I will say, I don't fully understand the Green River Formation. I'm not a geologist. I don't understand all about how that happened. But I want to say to you, it's not as simple as Mr. Lovell presented it on Tuesday night. And it's certainly not that clear an evidence for the long period of time he posited for it. And what I think you will find, my friends, is that oftentimes simple statements turn out to be much more complicated when you look at them carefully. And so much for the Green River Formation. Now I would like to take just a few moments, and that's all we have left, to talk just a moment about the geologic column, which was presented Tuesday night. So if I may have the first overhead. First thing I'd like to observe is what I told you on Tuesday night as well. And this is a quotation from a book called Geology by von Ingen and Castor. If a pile were to be made using each geologic age, it would be at least 100 miles high. Whereas the layers that you find actually on the earth are not much more than 1 to 1.5 miles high at the most. So the entire layer, if you took the largest thickness of all the layers posited around the world, would be some 100 miles thick. And as I said on Tuesday night, I'll say again, this geologic column that we'll see in just a moment is not found anywhere on earth. It's found in textbooks. The only way you can produce it is to put the layers together somehow from different places. Now, Mr. Lovell made the observation last night that creationists make an egregious error when they say that the geologic column is built on the theory of evolution. And so I'm not going to make that egregious error tonight. He made the observation that creationists in the early 1800s had basically put the column together before Darwin's theory became popular, and that is correct. That is correct. I would like to observe, however, that the men who did that worked primarily in Europe and England and worked with relatively limited amount of the Earth's surface in putting that together. And that since that time, any number of formations have been studied and discovered which present some problems for the commonly presented geologic column. Now, I would like to say again, I don't understand all about the geologic column. I can simply go on the basis of some things I have studied, and I want to present you a few. So if we may have the next one. Oh, let me read the bottom here. By application of the principle of superposition, that is, one layer on top of the other, which I might just observe to you, doesn't always work, and they know that, because you can't just say because one rock's lower than the other when it's older. That doesn't work always. Lithologic identification, that means you look at the rocks and see what kind it is, and certainly that in itself wouldn't allow you to layer rocks. Recognition of unconformities, that's areas between layers that look different, not level. And reference to fossil successions. Fossil successions. And I might say to you, if you want to take layers in England, and you want to correlate them with layers in America, the only way, ultimately, to do it is by the fossils that are in it. And Mr. Lovell said that last night. He said you must correlate with fossils, I believe. That they must be correlated with the fossils. In other words, ultimately, you can't say a layer over here in Wyoming is the same layer as one in England without some kind of markings in it. The rocks themselves, by themselves, will not do it. It's like having a blank deck of cards. You don't know how to put them together. You got to have something in it. Now, it is true that creationists put some of that together prior to the Darwinian theory. As I said, however, some things have been discovered since which throw some monkey wrenches in it, and all I want to do is say to you there are some anomalies that are hard to explain with the present geologic column and with the present geologic theories with regard to uniformitarianism. So here are some things that don't fit. Quick frozen Siberian mammoths, which we'll talk about in a moment. I don't want to take that one first. Formations that are out of sequence. Fossil graveyards, misplaced fossils, and polystrate fossils. And I have 2 minutes to talk about this. So let's talk about the first one. The second one, I should say. These are just some pictures of some formations that have been found in America, primarily in Canada. Well, there's one in Switzerland, in which the proposed layers of the geologic column, as you'll see them on this side, don't occur that way. And you see from the lines going out there that these occur in different orders than they are supposed to. Okay, let's go to the next one. There's some more in Wyoming and Montana where the layers are opposite, and these don't by any means exhaust the instances where layers don't fit the way they're supposed to. Now, there's two ways to explain that. One is to say, well, these layers are upside down because they got flipped. And that's generally what evolutionists say. They'll say if they're not in the order we think they should be, then they got flipped. And in some instances, you can find geologic evidence that there was a flipping. In others, you can't. So the question is, are the layers right or are they not? And there are some problems with that. Let's talk about how much time. Okay, I guess we won't talk about. We'll just pause there for a moment and pick up there later.
Well, I think it's good to be back. I may have to admit to an error or two myself here. We'll have to wait and see on that. I was unable to find with me the reference to a 2-mile-thick Green River formation
And so maybe I created that ex nihilo, and maybe I didn't, and I'll have to get back on that tomorrow night. I do want to make a few comments, though, before I proceed with what I was doing the first time. First is that Richard Lewontin, who said what he did about evolution is a fact, birds arose from non-birds, and so forth, I disagree that that is an accurate statement altogether. But he was feeling anger at having been misquoted, and I think that it's not reasonable to consider every utterance of every scientist as representing that man's most professional opinion about science. In some cases, it might be, and they are wrong when they say that. The evolution of kinds from other kinds, genera, families, orders, has not been proven unequivocally. And so when a scientist says that it has, he's wrong. He's wrong to do that. I don't believe that paleontologists kept the gaps in the fossil record a secret. They were never kept a secret from me, and I'm basically a member of the public at large.
I think they may have not admitted the severity of it with respect to the mode of gradualism suspected to be the way that evolution works. And in fact, Eldridge and Gould have proposed a theory contrary to gradualism, and I think they are trying to support that theory, and they're doing a good job of it, pointing out that paleontologists cannot continue to pretend that the severity of the gaps can be overwhelmed by another 50 years of searching. That's part of the point they're trying to make. New evidence, or the failure to produce new evidence, either way, can cause us to modify scientific theories. That's what science is all about. It's uncertain, and it's tentative, and it's changing. And so I don't know that they kept the gaps from us. They didn't keep them from me. But in any event, there are gaps there. Now, something important to mention is that there is not all gaps. Everywhere you look, there are not gaps. We believe we have many intermediates and some of those gaps plugged. Gould feels that the greatest number of gaps exist at the species level, but between higher levels of taxonomy, that there are a good deal of gaps that are not missing. They're non-gaps, so to speak. And we'll try to address that tomorrow. If lake barbs are not annual barbs or are not like annual rings, there are some problems that make it difficult to explain. That is to say that looking at barbs as being formed annually answers some questions. There are fossilized fish scales, which are banded like trees, and show whether fish died in the summer or winter. You can tell by looking at a fish scale whether a fish died in the summer or winter. Fish buried in the summer barb have summer death scales. They correlate. Same thing for winter. This is difficult to explain if barbs aren't also annual. There is a series of barbs in Australia that has an 11-year repeat in its pattern, which suggests sunspot cycle or corresponding with sunspot cycles. This is difficult to explain if barbs are not annual. Now, I can bury a thick catfish in tissue paper. I can lay down a sheet of tissue paper, and then another sheet of tissue paper, and at some point stick his catfish on there, and then another sheet of tissue paper, and another sheet of tissue paper, and then mash that fish way, way down so it is, as it's carbonized, caught between two layers of tissue, which are much thinner than the fish was thick. It is no mystery that things that are thicker than the layers that entrap them are found that way, I don't think. Geological column. I call it a construct. It is a construct. I did not, I hope, mislead anyone into thinking it all existed in one place, like the Bible. The geological column does not exist all in one place. I'll have some more to say about that tomorrow, though. I do need to prepare on that just a bit. See if there was anything else that I wanted to comment. I owe some comments, and I will present those tomorrow. Now, back to where we were. I want to examine the most frequent creation criticisms of naturalistic origin of life. These usually involve supposed improbability, the supposed improbability that anything as complicated as a protein or cell could not arise by chance. It's improbable that it would arise by chance. Now, you probably all heard stories about monkeys and typewriters, or hurricanes blowing through a junkyard, or a pile of bricks in the sun, and how the probability calculations have been made that show the impossibly large odds against biological molecules occurring by chance. The problem with all of these is that they make the wrong assumptions about how biological molecules work. There's a saying among computer buffs, garbage in, garbage out. Meaning that no matter how fancy your calculations, if you put in the wrong information and assumptions, you get out an impressive but meaningless answer. It is a calculation full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And that's just what these creationist calculations are, impressive but meaningless. The reasons why they are meaningless are summarized in this chart. Scientific creationist probability arguments against abiogenesis ignore the basic features of biological systems, replication, mutation, and selection. And they assume that only one particular sequence, or just a few, will work when in fact there are many possible sequences for most functions. They also assume that the entire target molecule must be assembled at once from scratch when it is very likely that the gradual stepwise chemical evolution leads to the target molecules over time. Building larger molecules by assembling smaller ones and adapting existing molecules to new functions. And they assumed that many functional proteins had to form simultaneously when it is more likely that the different molecules gradually evolve through stepwise chemical evolution and accumulation. See, if you would, what the second slide there is. Not that one, the next one. Yeah, on the left, we show an illustration of the approach the creationists appear to me to take, and that is that there's a bunch of loose little molecules, and in PIF we have a full-fledged protein molecule. Now, I'm not saying that every calculation made has been made this way, but all the ones I have seen are made this way. But this is not the way that we think that origin of life occurred. We think that real evolution at the chemical level occurred by one or two atoms getting together and forming a molecule. That's not too bad. And then a little later something else gets added to it, and that's not too bad either. And then later more gets added, and that is chemical evolution. We think this is the way that it works. Now perhaps Dr. Payne will give us one of these calculations and we can see which of these mistakes he has made. And maybe he hasn't made any, we will see. But remember, if you make mistakes like this, the number you come up with doesn't mean anything. The truth is, we don't know enough about how life formed to make such a calculation that is meaningful. Now, Monday night's presentation, Dr. Payne closed with some quotations dealing with the origin of life. He discussed the opinions of Hoyle and Wickramasinghe, I hope I pronounced that correctly, I've never met the man, that there was not possibly time for life to have arisen on Earth by naturalistic processes, and cited the analogy of monkeys with typewriters trying to type out the works of Shakespeare. Now, these men may be excellent astronomers and mathematicians, but they don't seem to know how biological molecules work, and their calculations are meaningless. Let's see why. Suppose we have an enormous number of monkeys trying to type out a particular passage of Shakespeare. By the way, there are many different approaches to this, and this is one of them that we've seen. And that there are many monkeys trying to type out a particular passage in Shakespeare, and they have 40 keys on the typewriter from which to hit each letter. Now, 39 out of the 40 will hit the wrong key. Now, here we're starting with 10 to the 21, I believe, monkeys. It's an arbitrarily large number. We just pick one. The first letter, and we want to type out to be or not to be from Shakespeare. Now, if all the monkeys randomly pick a letter and hit it, 1 in 40 is going to hit a T, and 39 out of 40 will not have hit a T. And the way the calculations of creations make, though, that they can't play the next round. They hit the wrong key. They have to start over. We send them back. Only those monkeys that hit the first tee get to play the next round. They've got a tee on their paper now. And so only 39 out of 40 is going to get the O right in the to be or not to be when they hit the second letter. And so we lose another whopping fraction of monkeys. They have to go back and start over all again. And so we're down to a smaller number. And the same thing is true for the space and for the B and the E. And it doesn't take long before we're only down to one monkey. We don't get that much more of a... Now, this is starting with 10 to the 21 power, or 10, or the number 1 with 21 zeros after it. We start with that many monkeys, and we end up with 1 before we get past the space and after not. We've used it up. Now, that's impressive, and that would convince me that you're not going to get Shakespeare typed by any number of monkeys in any reasonable period of time. But this has nothing to do with evolution, because it ignores the essential properties of biological molecules. They reproduce, and their amounts are adjusted by natural selection. And it demands, and these models also demand in advance what the specific goal is. And life doesn't work that way, we don't think. It doesn't seem to. All these monkeys had to start over again. But if this were to mirror the way that biological molecules evolve, whenever a monkey hits a T, he gets to go right on and hit an O. And if he didn't hit a T or an O, have we got another chart that supports that? I may be getting ahead. Yeah, I think I am. Let's consider it this way. Here's an analogy that includes the proper features of biological systems, and this is more how evolution works. At the top, we see various letters that are typed. Each letter is then copied many times, and in the process of reproduction. Occasionally, new letters are added by mutation. Some of these lead to unusable combinations, like T and X. And these are discarded. They're lost. However, these do not destroy all the progress that has been made. If you hit a TX over here, everybody doesn't quit. They have to go back to square one. But in Hoyle's model, they do. There are many good copies made that get cast aside and you have to start over with, because in Hoyle's model, you didn't come up with the whole thing at once. But some mutations that we have here lead to new useful combinations of letters, and they're preserved. The process of natural selection, those new useful combinations will reproduce faster than the old combinations. This is the analogy to natural selection, and make up larger proportions of the population. Further mutations gradually lead to evolution of long pieces of useful information. A very important thing to note here is that we don't have type any particular work of literature. Many other useful words and sentences can be formed. We can expand this model even further. There is no need to type the words in any particular order. We could have typed B first and then added 2 later, putting it in the right place. So you see that this model is more likely to lead to the production of useful information and is more like evolution and does not look like Hoyle's calculation, which is worthless. But what about other scientists Dr. Payne quoted? He quoted Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA. Surely he must know about biological molecules, Dr. Crick. Well, if you check his book, you won't see any monkey or typewriter analogies. He knows better than that. In fact, he explained some of the fallacies in these calculations, and had Dr. Payne read that part, he could have spared us that bit of misinformation. What does Crick say about calculating the probability of the origin of life? He says that since there are too many unknown factors, it is impossible for us to decide whether the origin of life here on Earth was very a rare event or almost certain to occur. I mean, that's the gap in our knowledge. It could go either way. Dr. Payne, however, on the basis of such meaningless calculations, has decided it could not have arisen naturally. Crick further stated that the plain fact is that the time available was too long, the many microenvironments on Earth's surface too diverse, the various chemical possibilities too numerous, and our own knowledge and imagination too feeble to unravel exactly how long it might or might not have happened such a long time ago, end quote, on the origin of life. And I agree with that. I'm not sure we know, and no one is claiming that life occurred naturally, only that it is a reasonable hypothesis that is gathering growing support from research. Now, the last quote of Crick's follows the quote Dr. Payne read, and it's on the same page of the book. Now, Dr. Payne went on to suggest that Dr. Crick wasn't very satisfied with the odds, so that he proposed that life came here on a spaceship. And this got a lot of laughter from the audience. However, what Crick said was that if new evidence came forth, which made it appear that the naturalistic origin of life on Earth was extremely unlikely, then other naturalistic explanations such as life from space should be considered. And given the molecular evidence that we found on meteorites, that's not so far-reaching. Now, this is the proper scientific approach, to recognize the limits of your knowledge and to be prepared to put forth new hypotheses when new knowledge fails to support the old hypotheses. However, to be scientific, such hypotheses must always call upon naturalistic explanations. That's not a denial of the supernatural. It says science can't probe or investigate the supernatural. So let us ask Dr. Payne, what portions of your model are subject to revision if new evidence and new scientific findings conflict with them? What kind of evidence, if any, would lead to you to revise your model? Beyond the revision you've already made respecting the age of the Earth to be only 6 to 10,000 years old or thereabouts, which I commend. I think that's a reasonable revision. Think we have time for that? Let me make a few other comments then. Dr. Payne quoted from the British paleontologist Colin Patterson, who said that evolution is often unnecessary in explaining biology. Now, Dr. Patterson has, for reasons related to the particular approach he takes with his specialty, cladistics, said that some things that many evolutionists are... Sorry, can't read... He frequently says things that many evolutionists disagree with, and this was one of them. He is by no means a creationist, and Dr. Payne didn't represent him to be either. But we can counter Dr. Payne with quotes of our own scientists who do believe that much of biology is explainable only in terms of evolution. In other words, where everything Colin says, we'll find someone else that says the opposite. Now, quotes don't really show much, and evidence does. That's one of the reasons why I try not to quote too many people, but sometimes it's necessary in order to establish a position. But we maintain that the evidence provided by comparative anatomy and biochemistry, the fossil record, and biogeography makes good sense in terms of evolution. It's explainable in terms of evolution, and scientific creationism does not explain them. Also, Dr. Payne told us on Monday night that evolution has to explain how the first living cell came about, and that it needs to demonstrate that everything can trace its ancestry back to a common ancestor. But that is not true. No scientific theory is required to explain everything completely. It has just to be able to account for the observations better than any other competing theory. That's the best we can do, until a new, even better theory comes along. And it has to be consistent with the observations. Evolution passes these tests with flying colors, we feel. The virtual whole of the scientific community feels that. Evolution passes the test with flying colors. It cannot explain everything, but it can explain many things. Scientific creationism, in contrast, seems to explain nothing. Whatever we see is how it was created. That's a good place to start, and I thank you for listening.
All right, I think I should make a few comments with regard to some of the things Mr. Lovell has said in response to me, so I guess I'm responding to his response, to my response. I'm very glad what he said about Mr. Lewontin, and I would not mean to say that every scientist and every statement he makes is going to be exactly accurate. I don't think either one of us would say that, but I think when they make statements, as leaders in the movement for the purpose of the public, they need to be careful. And if they are not accurate statements, they need to be corrected. I would say that for Henry Morris. I would say it for Richard Lewontin. And I was interested. I don't think he commented about the National Academy of Sciences. A rather prestigious group, and made a rather bold assertion, which I do not believe can be supported by the empirical evidence at all. That's not just one person. That is a committee, a council, that represents a large group of people. They, too, made that kind of a statement. Now, just briefly about that Green River bed again. He mentioned barbs. Now, what I said in my statement was that it's not established they are barbs. And so he went on and made several statements about barbs in Australia and barbs somewhere else. Nobody's agreed, evidently, that those are barbs in the Green River Formation. That's the problem. They're not all that clearly barbed layers. And then he gave you this explanation that if you took a fish and laid one tissue on it, and then another tissue on it, and then squished it, it could be well preserved. You got to remember, you're putting one tissue on in a year. And then the next year you get a tissue. You just don't preserve fish that well that way. That doesn't work. All right. With regard to the gaps, I suspect that they didn't just try to keep them secrets. But I do think what they did was fill them in with speculations. And that's basically the same thing. In fact, to the public, it was well established. I read you a quote Monday night from George Gaylord Simpson, The Meaning of Evolution, in which he said, it is a fact and there's no need for any further discussion. That was 1949. Now in the 70s, Stephen Gould and Niles Eldridge are saying the mechanism they were proposing back then is all wet. At least it can't work for the macroevolution, they say. But that's not what you'd get back in 1949. And they had to fill in a lot of gaps then to make that kind of statement. I'm asking you as the public to be careful when you read the statements of scientists. Henry Morris isn't the only one that makes pseudo-statements if he does. Now, with regard to these origin of life comments that Mr. Lovell has been making, I know that a lot of you will not be able, maybe some of you will not be able to come back tomorrow night. And I want to deal with those statements rather fully. But I want to take a little time to prepare, so I say it carefully, tomorrow night. I do want to have his transparency that we kept out. The colored one, this here, I think the comment I want to make about that is a nice story. That is a nice story. I want to see the empirical evidence that backs it up. That's a very nice story. There's very little, if any, empirical evidence in anywhere on that. And I will do further with that tomorrow. And the other one, if I may. In all of these calculations, there are calculations that do not ignore these things that he brought up and that come up with astronomical improbabilities for it. And I will be referring to some of those tomorrow night. I'll just tell you, there was an institute conducted in 1967 called the Wistar Institute. Mr. Lovell may be acquainted with it, in which they brought in some mathematicians, including Murray Eden from MIT, a man named Schutzenberger from Germany, and they had a knockdown dragout with the biologists over the neo-Darwinian theory and the absolute improbability that it could have occurred and accounted for the living things today. They're evolutionists, by the way. It wasn't a creationist against evolutionists. They're general theorists. Another point about the origin of life. If we know so little about it, which is accurate, I think, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. We need to be very careful about what we publish in textbooks and how we say it in that case. If it is not science, if it's beyond the realm of science, and I think that's the point I want to make, any position on origins is ultimately beyond the realm of science. I said that at the beginning, and I'll say it again. It is accurate that when you posit a creator, there's no scientific way to investigate a creator as such. All I have tried to say is it is reasonable to use the methods of science to investigate whether it's reasonable to posit a creator. Not that you can investigate the creator scientifically, neither can you investigate the ultimate origin scientifically. Ultimately, you can look at it in scientific ways. You can do experiments and look at things and posit things, but ultimately it is beyond the realm of science. Any position on origins is, and that's been my position from the beginning. Now, I can't pass up the opportunity to just say another word about old Colin Patterson, because he is an interesting character. In our time, he's a sort of a renegade in some ways, and he's been willing to stick his nose out a little bit, and he about got it chopped off. And what I wanted to mention to you on, I forget which night, I mentioned to you about Mr. Patterson's reaction. When he made some of these statements that could be used by creationists to support their view, he got taken to the backyard and whooped. And he felt it. And in his interview with Tom Bethel that I quoted to you from the other night, he let that be known. I have here a copy of a speech he made at the American Museum of Natural History in 1981. He published his book on evolution in 1978. This speech was made in 1981. He said, and this was made before a group of general theorists, evolutionists, at the American Museum. One of the reasons I started taking this anti-evolutionary view, or let's call it a non-evolutionary view, and that's 3 years after he wrote his book on evolution now, was last year I had a sudden realization. For over 20 years I had thought I was working on evolution in some way. I mean, he's an expert paleontologist. One morning I woke up and something had happened in the night, and it struck me that I'd been working on this stuff for 20 years and there was not one thing I knew about it. That's quite a shock to learn, that one can be so misled so long. Either there was something wrong with me or there was something wrong with evolutionary theory, and naturally I know there's nothing wrong with me. So, for the last few weeks, I've tried putting a simple question to various people or groups of people. The question he asked people was, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that is true? I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History. And the only answer I got was silence. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar in the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists. All I got was silence for a long time. And eventually one person said, I know one thing, it ought not to be taught in high school. Now, I know, as Mr. Lovell said, you can quote one scientist expert on one side, and he can come up here and quote another one on the other side. I know that. He can probably quote 16 of them on the other side. All I want to say is, here's one expert paleontologist that has come to the conclusion, I don't know anything about evolution. Now, that's interesting to me. And he's starting to say anti-evolutionary things. And he's not the only one. And please don't misunderstand me. He's not a Bible-toting creationist by any means. And all I'm trying to say is, can't we leave the thing open and allow both sides to be presented? Would it not be a healthy thing? And are not the things I'm presenting to you approached from a scientific perspective, in which you can take the data and interpret it differently than Mr. Lovell does? Now let's go back to our place where we were. We were mentioning things that don't fit in the geologic column and in the interpretation of it. And we were talking about formations out of sequence, and we don't need to put those up again, but you might put the second one we had on the formations, I'm sorry. You know, we did two on formations. Put the second one up there again, just as an illustration. Whoops, backwards. All right, those are just illustrations of formations that are out of sequence, in which the layers don't fit in the layers the way they're supposed to. I'd like to read this quotation from Luther Sunderland, who went and interviewed five of the leading paleontologists of our time, and he wrote this book called Darwin's Enigma. And at the end of the book, he said, "Furthermore, it appears that greatly different conditions existed in the past when a tropical-like climate extended to polar regions. Animals and plants grew to very large sizes." These are some things he's saying we can conclude from all that we know at the present. "It's also true that rocks classified in every geological period, all of those periods, at one place or another, lay directly on the rocks which have no fossils in or below them, the bottom ones." He said, "Somewhere on Earth, every one of those layers is perched right on the layers that have no fossils below them. Due to the common practice among geologists to ignore evidence, which does not agree with evolution theory or uniformitarianism, it's difficult for us to obtain an accurate picture of the geologic data." Now, that's his opinion. And I would have to say that sometimes, based on some of the quotes I've given you, sometimes maybe some data is ignored, like all the gaps in the record, or it is speculated upon to fill in the gaps. All right, now let's look at some of the other problems, some of the other anomalies that are difficult to account for. This is the official explanation in a book put out by the U.S. Department of Interior of the Lewis Overthrust in Montana, one of the pictures you saw earlier. They say that what happened is that this rock bubbled up here and that it kind of slid over on top of the other layers. That's what you call an overthrust. And that because of that, you ended up with this formation down at the bottom with older layers on top of younger layers. That's called an overthrust. And as I've said to you, there are places on Earth where you can clearly show in the rock record there must have been an overthrust because of the layering and because of the layer between them that shows extensive damage. In the case of the Lewis overthrust in Montana, this massive layer of rock, 350 miles by 35 to 40 miles and 6 miles thick, cannot possibly be an overthrust. An overthrust exists when one layer of rock is pushed up over another layer due to some natural catastrophe or other. The sheer size and condition of the Lewis layer argues against an overthrust there. There's no evidence of overthrusting, and this refers to a picture which I do not have, but some geologists have studied various places where you ought to see evidence of it sliding across as it thrusts over, and in the places where they have looked, there have not been the clear delineations. The line is sharp, unlike conditions for an overthrust. I say again, I am not a geologist, but that looks like an anomaly to me. Okay, let's go to the next thing. The quick frozen Siberian mammoths. Gigantic torrents of water and huge earth movements buried many forms of life, some being frozen in icy, mucky graves and preserved for thousands of years. This mammoth, uncovered by excavators in Siberia, was frozen solid in sitting position thousands of years ago by engulfing icy muck. Vegetation was still in its mouth and stomach. Its flesh was edible when thawed out. I'm sure you're aware of the mammoth beds in Siberia and much of the ivory that's been taken out of there. It's hard to explain that on a uniformitarian basis. It must have been a sudden catastrophe of some kind, a rather extreme one. Let's go to the next one. We're now going to look at fossil graveyards. That's just an example of a fossil graveyard. Bones of rhinoceroses, camels, giant wild boars buried at Agate Springs, Nebraska. Estimated that 9,000 complete animals were buried in one hill. Those things speak to rather catastrophic events. Let's go to another one. All right, this is a report from Mr. F.A. Barnes, reported in a recent find, two human skeletons in 100-million-year-old Utah rock. The strata in which the fossils were found was classified as Lower Dakota, Upper Morrison. J. Marwitt, an anthropologist at the University of Utah, declared that the bones were obviously human and found in situ. That is, they were not washed into position. 15 or more feet of rock above the bones was bulldozed off and was reported as continuous and unbroken, with about 6 feet being solid rock. The skeletons were articulated, that is, bones were together at the joints, and stained green by the copper salts from the surrounding rocks. In turn, the surrounding rocks were stained by the organics from the bodies. By its position in the rocks, the discovery places man about 97 million years before any of his speculated evolutionary precursors. An unusual find, to say the least. Okay, next. I'm sure Mr. Lovell's familiar with this one, the human sandal print. Not only is this sandal print, but it's the sandal print of the right foot, evident from the wear of the sandal on the heel. In the photo, the object on the left is the actual print. The one on the right is the negative, formed by the layer of silt that filled in the original print afterward and then hardened. In the heel is a fossil trilobite, supposedly one of our ancestors. Print is definitely in Cambrian rock, but the evolutionist hypothesis does not allow for man to have lived that far back. Let's put it up there. Trilobite embedded over here. Human sandal print and its reverse, or its opposite. Okay? Then at the Paluxy River in Glen Rose, Texas, prints shown of obvious human origin cannot be explained as those of a giant ground sloth, nor can they possibly have been manufactured. There's no evidence at all of their having been chiseled in the rocks by human hands. Let's take a look at those, if we may. Or look at some. If you look there, you see some prints. You may not be able to discern that too well. But those particular prints are the human-like footprints found in Laetoleil in the region of Tanzania by Mary Leakey. Those are the ones she found. These are casts of the ones found at the Paluxy Riverbed in Glen Rose, Texas, at the same place they have all those dinosaur tracks. All right? Another anomaly. Dr. Clifford Burdick has studied considerably at the Grand Canyon, and he has found conifer spores. Using the facilities of the University of Arizona, he's extracted a number of such evidences that ancient rock and modern plants are not so far as evolutionists maintain. There are some anomalies in the geologic record, and here is one that is extremely widespread. They are polystrate fossils. Just briefly, these fossils are usually large plants that extend through several layers that if those plants were not there, those trunks, if that wasn't there, an evolutionist interpreting that would normally say that the coal and the shale would have formed over long, long periods of time. But because of the presence of the polystrate, it makes a problem because that thing got trapped in all those layers, as did these. The one at the top, the fossil tree, penetrates a visible distance of 10 feet through volcanic sandstone at Clarno Formation in Oregon. Potassium-argon dating of the nearby John Day Formation suggests that 1 foot of rock was deposited over a period of about 7 million years, or in other words, at the rate of a thickness of... I can't read it. Anyway, not too thick, a year. And there's that long tree that's trapped there. Now, the problem with that is, how does it stay there for thousands and thousands of years while all those layers are forming? It's a real problem. And polystrates are a widespread phenomenon. Just show one more. I think I have a little less than a minute. This one appeared in Scientific American and is a huge one. And it has layers that start with coal and go through sandstone and up through shale. That's very hard to explain without some major catastrophe. And I think my time is up. Thank you.
I'm going to have a lot of things that I'm going to need to work on to respond to. And I'm going to try to get some of it in my last 10 minutes tonight, but some I'm going to have to carry over to tomorrow. Right now I'd like to discuss human evolution. Dr. Payne Tuesday made an impressive presentation concerning the absence of real evidence for human evolution. The way he did it was, in my view anyway, to ignore most of the evidence and misrepresent the extent of fossil findings of man's ancestors. Let's look at a chart that Dr. Payne used entitled The Amount of Evidence Available in 1972 for the Artistic Construction of the Various Forms of Men and Apes. Now, it looks pretty scanty. There are only a few bones and teeth here and there until you get down to the Neanderthals and Cro-Magnon. You should realize, however, that anthropologists spend their careers studying bones and teeth of both living and extinct animals, and they really can tell a very great deal from a single tooth or a piece of a jaw. And we know they do well because when we later find more, most of their findings are borne forward. They're not wild speculations that are made off of these. But they are conjectures, I grant, until we do find more evidence. But they're not wild ones. Dr. Payne said, quote, "This chart was constructed in 1972. Some things have happened since then. I do not have the time, but I do have the documentation of what fossils have been found since the chart was made, and I can tell you it doesn't change a whole lot." Well, now, I think that's a value judgment, but keep that phrase in mind. It doesn't change a whole lot. Let's start out with proconsul. Parts shaded in gray. Have you got a slide to whip up there? This is proconsul. The parts shaded in gray were known in 1951, and these are much more extensive than Dr. Payne's table shows. The colored sections are more recent additions, which you can see gives us a much clearer picture. Now let's consider Ramapithecus. While Tom's getting that ready, you'll remember that this is the one where Dr. Payne stripped away the flesh and the musculature and the skeletons to end up with just a little bit of a jaw and a skull. Now here's a quote from Richard Leakey dealing with a reconstruction like the one Dr. Payne showed you. Quote, "On the right, a reconstruction of Ramapithecus, which, because so few remains have been found, must be very tentative." Here he's properly expressing the limits of his knowledge. It's not like he threw this up and said, or anything like this, and said, "This is the gospel truth." However, since Dr. Payne's picture and Leakey's quote, a much better specimen has been found. These may be difficult to see, I'm sorry about that, but from the front we have the entire face, and over here is a side view. By the way, the lower jaw and teeth from the earlier specimen you saw fit exactly this specimen. Next, let's consider Australopithecus, where a number of spectacular fossil finds have been made since Dr. Payne's chart was made. Now, he did mention Lucy, but he incorrectly said she's not considered part of human lineage. She's not, perhaps, by all. Have you got the next chart there? I've got one that... No, the one of Lucy's lineage. Not there? Okay. Well, we may have to reinforce that with some tomorrow. Anyway, let me tell you about it. I wish we had the chart. Australopithecus is now divided into three species, Africanus, Robustus, and Afarensis. Afarensis is the type to which the famous Lucy skeleton belongs. Lucy is a collection of nearly half a complete skeleton. Near her were found a collection of Australopithecus bones from at least 13 individuals, all mixed up. Together with Lucy, they total 350 fossil pieces. This photo shows the Lucy bones, along with other that were found there, skulls, that very, very back row, those skulls, not the back row, the back group of skulls belong to chimpanzees. But all these in the middle ground are Afarensis bones, Australopithecus afarensis. This is the Lucy skeleton there. You can see it's more than a jawbone. And there are more jawbones there, and only in the corner here. These are not found in the same location. They're bones from other surrounding areas, which may or may not be Australopithecus bones. There's quite a few, quite a collection. The next diagram shows the extent... make sure that's the one, yeah, okay. The next diagram shows the extent, by being darkened in, of the actual evidence of three major types of Australopithecus. The skulls are very well known, but have not been blackened in so that you can see the details on the chart. And on the right is modern man over there. In addition to these fossils and more recent finds, Mary Leakey has found the footprints which were mentioned a little while ago at Laetoli. One thing to note about those footprints, we suspect that they are footprints. Mary Leakey suspects they are footprints of hominids, and we found lots of hominid bones in the area. When I talk about Biloxi, remember that, please, if I forget to tell you. Between Australopithecus and those fossils placed in our own genus, Homo, we find, as evolution predicts, a number of intermediate species which are hard to put in one group or the other. In other words, it's hard to make just a clear separate, can't be this one and can't be that one, and that's one reason why we think they fit in the middle. These specimens don't appear in Dr. Payne's table. Also missing is an entire group of fossils classified as Homo habilis, the earliest form associated with stone tools. Now we come to Homo erectus, a perfect intermediate between man and his ape-like ancestors. This is Homo erectus. You will see that Dr. Payne's chart shows Homo erectus is known from one skull, five teeth, and one leg and a foot bone. Now this is really not correct. Let me read from a Scientific American article which describes fossil finds of Peking man, one type of Homo erectus. Quote, the fossils of Peking man discovered over the past 50 years have been cataloged as follows. 6 complete or almost complete skulls and 12 other skull fragments, 15 pieces of mandibles, 157 teeth, 3 fragments of humerus, the bone of the upper arm, 1 clavicle or collarbone, 7 fragments of the femur, which is the thigh bone, 1 fragment of the tibia, 1 lunate bone or wrist bone shaped like a half moon. And the fossils represent material from more than 40 male and female individuals who died at various ages. In addition to the fossils, we have excellent evidence for stone tools and the use of fire by Peking man. In addition to Peking man, we have other specimens of Homo erectus from Java, Europe, and Africa. And while we're on this, look over at the right and you can see how Peking man and Java skulls are in between those of Australopithecus and Neanderthal man. At that, if you look over there, the cranial capacity or size of the brain is also intermediate. Now, to be fair, to Dr. Payne, most of this evidence was known before 1972, but we'd have to place the blame on its omission upon the creationists who prepared the chart, and not Dr. Payne. But surely there is no excuse for missing this one. This was widely reported in newspapers and magazines, and let me read you from this article in Time magazine of October 29, 1984. Quote, it is the most nearly complete skeleton of an early human ancestor that has ever been discovered. More than 70 bones and fragments. No two are duplicates, and all are the same age and maturity, indicating that they belong to the same individual. The only missing pieces of the skeletal puzzle are the hominid's left arm and hand, right arm from the elbow down, and most of both feet. That's the end of quote. Now, why do you suppose that Dr. Payne showed a tiny piece of Ramapithecus to illustrate the extent of the evidence for man's ancestors when we have nearly a complete Homo erectus and half a complete Lucy? I mean, maybe he doesn't want you to see the evidence. I'm not saying that the point he had to make on Ramapithecus was not well made, but it is the extreme case representing the hominid fossils that are available. Let us recall that Dr. Payne said that since 1972, the evidence for human evolution hasn't changed a whole lot. So misinterpreting the impressive and ever-growing fossil record of man's evolution seems inexcusable because it looks like we have had some major changes between then and now. But it could be a matter of opinion. I mean, if you don't interpret this evidence as being significant, then it's reasonable, I guess. Thank you.
All right, just a few comments about that human evolution part, and we'll maybe respond a little more to that tomorrow night. As he said, I did tell you that there were further fossil finds since. He did bring up one I was not aware of, that last one. I just had not seen that one. And I'm glad to know about that. In my study of this thing, I did take those original figures from another person. And I did do some checking of them as best I could in the references I had and found further fossil finds, which I have documented. I don't have it here with me tonight. So I was aware that there were other fossil finds since that time. I was also aware that as the evolutionists, the general theorists, have interpreted that evidence, we are in as big a problem as we ever have been about the lineage. Now, I would like, if I may, to have that one on Homo habilis and the three Australopithecines. Could you get me that one and let me see it up here again? The three in a row. And while he's talking about this, this is taken from a book by Oxnard, Evolutionary Radiation Suggested by the New Evidence. He did a study on the fossils that were available. And I wasn't planning to show this tonight, so I don't have the actual documentation with me, but it's by Oxnard. And I just wanted to show you that in his study of the evidence, and this was in the 80s, I believe. Don't hold me to that because I'm not absolutely sure. I think it was in the early 80s. Here's what he came up with. Here's Ramapithecus off here on the side. And then, see all the question marks? And then there are the Australopithecines over there in a totally separate lineage, which, as I understand, is the most commonly accepted view today. I'm sure it's not unanimous. And one of the reasons it isn't unanimous is because it's so hard to handle those human fossils and know exactly what they mean and where to fit them. But up here is Homo erectus and Homo sapiens, and how do they get there? Well, according to his theory, a lot of question marks. And that's basically what you've got with human evolution, and that's the point I was trying to make. And in connection with Ramapithecus, the point I was trying to make is that oftentimes reconstructions go way beyond. I know a paleoanthropologist can tell a lot from a tooth, but he can't tell all that. And I understand, I have Leakey's book on origins, and he does say that the evidence is rather scanty, but he does allow a picture to be presented, and nobody in time life makes such a disclaimer, which is the popularization of it. It is that to which I object. Now I'd like to turn to another topic which ties in with some of the points that we've made, and we'll do this as expeditiously as we can. If we have the first overhead. I want to talk just a little bit about genetics, which is certainly one area of concern to us in this discussion. Genetics, of course, is the study of the mechanism inside the cells by which reproduction comes about, and by which you pass on your particular characteristics to your progeny. A lot has been learned about genetics since Darwin's days. I'd like to present to you some of the evidence that's available to us now. Among animals that reproduce sexually, no two are exactly alike. The individuals of every species vary in size, proportions, colorations, external and internal structure, physiology, and habits. And you know that. Your children don't look exactly like you, and probably thank goodness for that. I'm certainly thankful for that, that they don't look like me exactly. There's a lot of variation, that's a fact, isn't it, with any given group. Changes in the genetic constitution of an organism may be due to new combinations, we call that genetic recombinations, to chromosome mutations, that is, changes in the chromosome structure, rather large changes, and I might say to you, if you change the chromosome as a unit and take out large pieces of it, it is extremely damaging. And gene mutations, or as they are called, point mutations. Those are the ways that the genetic material can be changed. I might add, though, that in the combinations, you're really just rearranging what's already there, and that's how we get most of the variety that we see in a gene pool, is by recombining, particularly is that true in sexual reproduction. All right, it is now evident that there's only one situation in which a gene pool can be completely reconstituted genetically, and that's by spatial isolation. And Mr. Lovell mentioned this Monday night. Get a group of squirrels over here and a group of squirrels isolated over here, and you can get isolation. And so the gene pool can be reconstituted. Now, another bit of evidence. And remember, we've tried throughout this debate to say, let's look at the evidence, and then let's look at how it's interpreted. So we're trying to look at the evidence right now. A great deal of study has been done on this little fellow, Drosophila, what is it, melanogaster? We'll call him the fruit fly or Drosophila. One reason so much study has been done on him in genetics is because he is conveniently First place, folks don't care much about him. And in the second place, he conveniently reproduces every couple of weeks. You get a new generation every couple of weeks. So you can do a lot of generations in a relatively short period of time and study what happens to him. So in studies of genetics and mutations particularly, they've done everything you can think of to this guy. They've bombarded him with ultraviolet rays. They've hit him with this, that, and the other to mutate him unnaturally. And they've ended up with different things, curly wings, stubby wings, yellow body color, white eyes, lethal. Some of them are absolutely killed by the mutations, and others have these various things. And here's kind of a summary of what kinds of things you can do to a poor old Drosophila. You start with his original eye up there on the top, and you can mutate him until he's got a blind eye, no eye at all. And you can change his wing structure. You see all these different wing structures down here at the bottom? That can be done by mutations. In fact, I'm understanding that they've come out with one now that's produced four wings, according to my expert helper here, and by mutations. But did you know, we just did a rough calculation, and please understand, for Mr. Lovell's sake, this is rough. Let's say there's about 1,000 institutions in our country that are studying Drosophila, and I can't imagine that there aren't more than that. I haven't done a careful study. And that maybe twice a year they have a genetics lab in which they study fruit flies. And I suspect there are a lot more than that. That's 2,000 classes per year. Let's say there's 15 pairs of students working together. That'll give you 30,000 experiments done per year in these institutions on Drosophila. And I suspect that's rather conservative. And suppose that's happened for 50 years. Actually, Drosophila has been studied since about 1910. But let's say for about 50 years that's been done. That's 1,500,000 generations of Drosophila that have been investigated. If you translate that into human generations times 35, you would get 105 million years worth of mutating. In other words, you can take a two-week span, you can keep bombarding this thing with mutants over and over again. They've studied him and studied him and studied him and studied him. Mutated him to see what happens. And after all those experiments and all those tries, what they have ended up with is Drosophila. Mutants, most of the time, are deleterious. They're harmful. Everybody admits that. Mutations are rarely, if ever, non-harmful and rarely, if ever, beneficial. And so I would like to ask Mr. Lovell in his discussion sometime to tell us about some beneficial mutations, which are the way that the genetic code can really be changed. And mutations, I might add, are totally random. They are not made because the organism needs it or on any particular basis other than the fact that something in nature hits that organism, strikes one of the cells, and mutates part of its gene structure. That's a random process. Now, if you have a random process, even if it's acted on after it's done by natural selection, which we've not had the time to describe, will you be able to explain by those mechanisms, which is what Mr. Lovell presented to us Monday night, the general theory of evolution? Let's have the next one. That one. You've got it in your hand. In other words, this is pretty much what it's like. Take a race car from Indianapolis, Indiana, and take a small bullet and fire it right through the engine. That's kind of what you're doing when you mutate a gene. And with that mechanism associated with natural selection, we're supposed to be able to account for all of the living forms that exist today, starting with one-celled organisms and all the way up to today. At least that's one explanation, the neo-Darwinian. Thank
you. This is my last speech for the evening, and I appreciate y'all staying around and listening to me to rant and rave. I told David Watts if I survive this debate, I'm going to quit smoking. And I'm going to... First thing I'd like to do is in reference to comments about the Australopithecus position in our lineage, is show the chart that I couldn't get my hands on earlier. This bottom one shows, with a question mark, no doubt about it. This is Oxnard. Based on readings of the description of the fossils, Oxnard was willing in 1979 to say that Operensis maybe belonged right there where the homo is in the question mark. That's not conclusive, I grant that. But that's the latest that I heard on it. But now, that doesn't mean that there isn't something newer, and I would be interested to see that. Johansson and White place Australopithecus Operensis directly in man's lineage, with the Australopithecus Africanus and Robustus being the branch off. Now, these are opinions, and there isn't a consensus that I know of on hardly anything that we might present. We'll always be able to find somebody that disputes it. But there's a debate going on. But the point we were trying to make was that some people place Operensis in man's lineage and leaves the other two Australopithecus out, and further that there have been substantial fossil finds since 1972.
That's all I'll have for that chart right now.
In case of fruit flies, that's a tough one. I admit that, and I've wrestled with that, tried to figure that out myself. I don't know who's got the answer. But let me tell you what occurs to me, why we have done millions upon millions upon millions of mutations and we still have just fruit flies. First, I want to mention, though, that we have modified those fruit flies in virtually every conceivable way, and have them remain still fruit flies, but they are still fruit flies. But those experiments are done in isolation of a sort, not allowed to continue to term, if you will. This is purely my conjecture now, and it may make sense to you, it may not. I'm going to have to research it further. But in nature, when you have any kind of independent genetic change of a subpopulation, there is a period of time where that population continues in isolation from its parent, because it's undergoing a genetic independence, genetic changes independently. You reach a point where it cannot then subsequently interbreed when reunited with the original population. We say that's a new species. Whether they're reunited or not, and we ever even know, that process continues. There are mutations, some die. Maybe the majority of mutations result and are fatal, but there are some, we believe, that are beneficial, and then they continue, and then there is a lot of them. You have one, and then you have very many, and some of them survive new mutations, and some of them die. But you're taking generation after generation after generations going through this filter of natural selection and mutation. Whereas in the case of fruit flies, you buy stock, you run your experiments for a couple of weeks or months or whatever, and then you toss them out, or they're unusable anymore, and you start over again, and you haven't got the end to end to end. Maybe that isn't convincing. I don't know. It's the best I can do on that. I'm really pleased that I never claim to know everything.
Too close. All right.
Regarding Paluxy River footprints, most of those prints have been judged. I said that wrong. A good many of the prints that have been found there and highly advertised and touted have been judged by many professional scientists who have visited them to have been carved. They have anatomical errors in them. Some of them don't make the kind of a print you would have expected in that surface. There have been quite a few scientists take a look at those, and they've been unconvinced. There's also been a good number of There have been some creationist scientists visit the Paluxy River findings who had everything to gain from attesting to the genuineness of what they found there, and that was the Seventh-day Adventists. And Baptists have been there from a college whose name escapes me, and I'll produce for you tomorrow.
And they were not convinced by what they found. Neither are non-creationist scientists who go there. I just want to summarize it up quickly, though, this way. And, by the way, I read John Morris's book on the Paluxy River, Those Incredible Dinosaurs and the Men Who Chased Them. Was that the title? I know I'm close. But anyway, he wrote the book about all of the finds, and I could not find in there anywhere where he underwrote or attested to or endorsed as authentic any of the contemporary finds, including the famous Morris print. I've got a picture of that I'll try to show you tomorrow. In his judgment, he was not willing to come out and say any of them were authentic. What he did was say he is confident that the stories 50, 60 years ago that he has heard by hearsay are legitimate. That those were genuine. But anyway, in review of the evidence of the Paluxy River, it's known that Paluxy River inhabitants have created human-like footprints, carved them, and enhanced fortuitous depressions by chiseling and carving. I mean, it's known that that has happened. It's also known that erosion of dinosaur footprints can create depressions which resemble human footprints. Many creationists, oh, here is the evidence I was looking for, or not the evidence, the comment. Baptists from Columbia Union College and Seventh-day Adventists had visited there, and they were unconvinced and had everything to gain by what they found. Now, Paluxy River Formation has many alleged dinosaur footprint tracks, numerous fossilized dinosaur bones, whole skeletons in some cases, some alleged human footprint tracks, but no fossilized human bones or even any which are primate. Now, that suggests that the footprints are not authentic from the humans and are from the dinosaurs. Now,
maybe it's still an open issue, but many scientists that have been there have been unconvinced by what they found. I think I have lost a card. I want to comment on the frozen mammoths, but I want to comment fully, and I really don't want to start it and break it off later. So let me just at this point say thank you very much for listening, and now let's listen carefully to Dr. Payne for his final speech.
I'm getting to appreciate Frank more as the time goes on. I especially appreciate his shortening up his time there, and I think I'll do the same. I know everybody's flat worn out. You all look like you're kind of wilted. So I will just take just a few minutes, summarize briefly what I have tried to do in the first three nights of this debate. I can't pass up the opportunity, though. I've got to say something about Drosophila. Poor old Drosophila. I mean, he was mutated a lot more than you'd ever get in nature. I mean, my calculations were so off because the mutations that were done upon him were done by people much faster than they'd happen in nature. And there's no comparison. And many of the experiments were done for many, many, many generations in order. They didn't just cut them off and throw them away. So it's not just that. So there's a problem there. And I want to say, too, I told you I'm learning to appreciate Frank Moore each day. And he is candid, and I'm trying to be candid, too. And he said to you he doesn't know for sure about that one, and I appreciate that. I think that's what a scientist should do. I think I'm willing to do that, too. There's some things in the fossil record I don't know about. And, in fact, he presented something here about Paluxy Riverbed I didn't know about. I'm going to look at it further and see, because I didn't know that. And I may quit making that argument, too. I don't know. I'll see. I'll have to find out. All right, now, let's do a little summary. We've tried to say from the beginning that the issue is not scientific fact versus religious faith. That's not what we're talking about. The issue is which position of faith is more reasonable based on the interpretation of the data. Now, Mr. Lovell keeps saying, if you posit a creator, you've gone outside of science. And I admit that. I'm saying if you posit the general theory, you've gone outside of science too. Now, you can keep trying natural means to test it, so can I. But when you posit that general theory, you've stepped right outside, because you're dealing with origins. You cannot ultimately demonstrate it. You've stepped outside. All right? The issue is not scientific data. The issue is how the data is interpreted. I've kept trying to stress that over, and we've tried to make a distinction. I've tried to tell you that oftentimes the data is presented with its slant to it. If you've been listening, you've seen that over and over this week, how you get scientific data that's presented to you, already interpreted for you. And I'm asking you to watch out for that. And we're saying the position is, it's like before a judge. You see, this position of origins is not like regular science. In regular science, you're dealing with what's here right now. You can take that floor and you can mangle it, smash it up, test it chemically, do anything you want to it. It's here, right now. When you're talking about unique historical events, you can't do that. We're talking about a time in the past. It's more like this situation. You got to leave it up there a minute. You've got a prosecuting attorney and a defense attorney who are both dealing with the same evidence, and you're trying to say which is more reasonable, you be the judge. I think that's healthy, and I think when scientists say you cannot present the opposing view, that's not healthy. Okay? And the basic difference between Mr. Lovell and me on this question is this. Can all living things be traced back to a common ancestry? A single common ancestry, or just a very few at the bottom? Or is it more reasonable to believe that there were separate creations which have then varied? I showed you on the first night abundant physical evidence that is extremely difficult to explain any other way than by creation. It's more reasonable to say first life was created. I showed you on Tuesday night a great deal of evidence from the fossil record readily attested to that there are tremendous gaps between them which must be accounted for, and I'm still interested in hearing what Mr. Lovell is going to say about that and how he's going to account for those gaps. They are most reasonably explained, in my view, in the sudden appearance by a creation model, which fits with this forest model as opposed to the tree model. And we've tried to keep this distinction in your mind. The special theory of evolution, limited change, we have no quarrel with. Limited change, and that's abundantly testified to by the evidence. It's the general theory that we're questioning, and we do not believe it is established. And Mr. Lovell, I'm glad to say again tonight, I'm glad to say again about him that he has said it should not be stated as a fact. And you know, I wouldn't get so upset if everybody would do that. But that's just not the way it works. And I've got to say this. Mr. Lewontin's quote that I gave you was published in a book by Mr. Futuyama, however you pronounce that, as a representation in a book directed against creationists, and a rather vitriolic book, I might add, which included that quote from Mr. Lewontin and several others to say any idiot knows this is the truth. So it wasn't just Mr. Lewontin was angry on one occasion. That was published in a book and sent around to make fun of creationists. There's a lot of difference. And the same man came back later and said that was a weak statement. Now, I hope this week has been valuable to you, and I hope you can come back tomorrow night, and I want to say in conclusion again, I appreciate the way Mr. Lovell has handled it this week, and I hope that he feels the same, and that we have been honorable in all. Good night.